activity in Camelot, with only one or two blind spots where I hadn't been able to sneak in a camera. Marvin waved his glass of cognac in the general direction of a group of young Deltons. He'd picked up the habit from Howard over at Vulcan, and I still got a kick out of it. "So, Camelot has street gangs now," he said. "Are they going around hot-wiring teepees?" I responded with an eye roll and an exaggerated nod, then answered, "This is pretty recent behavior. I think it might have something to do with population density. They're getting too crowded, and the tents take up more space, which just makes it worse." "Everything has side effects," Marvin said with a smile. "Have you noticed the gangs are co-ed?" Yeah. I'm sure a sociologist would have something to say about that, but the libraries don't have much in the way of that particular discipline." Marvin snorted. "Doesn't strike me as a field of study that theists would approve of, you know?" I nodded. "Too bad, though. The last mating season was significantly more violent. Two Deltons ended up dying from injuries, and now we're getting face-offs between the Hexki. It worries me." "You could busterize someone." "Not funny, Marv." Marvin shrugged. He knew that I'd been staying strictly out of sight since my banishment. I couldn't take the chance of fallout from a Bob sighting affecting Archimedes. After a moment, he added, "On the other hand, Bob, the problems we are seeing are a result of the Delton population going up. As problems go, it's a hell of a lot better than the problem you first found them with." I smiled, as much at Marvin's transparent attempt to make me feel better as anything. But he was right. When I found the Deltons, attrition had been slowly killing them off. A rising population was infinitely better, for all the issues it was causing. "So, what do we do?" "Nothing. At least for the moment. I'm banished, remember?" I shrugged. "I suppose this is that point where I step away and let the Deltons make their own destiny. I talked about it in the past, but I guess I always expected it to be my choice, not forced on me." I gave Marvin a lopsided grin, and he laughed. "I'm sure most parents feel that way at some point." 34. Moose. Bill. June 2185, Epsilon Eridani. I could feel the wind on my face as I ran. This was nothing like VR. I controlled Bullwinkle directly. Well, sort of, as he ran over the surface of Ragnarok. I was easily holding 70 kph, the android's reflexes taking care of the limb coordination at that speed. The system was still far from perfect. In order to make this work, I had two drones following the moose. Radio comms between Bullwinkle and the drones were relayed via Scut to me. It was more a proof of concept than a practical solution. But ignoring the Rube Goldberg communications, I now had a physical presence on the surface of the planet. I slowed down as I approached my target coordinates. As I jogged up to the patch of green, I marveled at the smooth feel of the muscles working under the skin. It occurred to me that the VR experience was missing this level of detail. I'd have to correct that. The VR was coming due for a patch release anyway. I stopped at the edge of the green. I engaged close-up visual and examined the moss-lichen mix. It had taken some brutally heartless breeding to come up with a mix that could survive in this atmosphere. I'd probably had less than a 1% survival rate on each generation for a while. But the result, in front of me, was justification for all the effort. The green area was taking in CO2 and putting out oxygen. Only during the day, granted, but I'd bred it to go into a deep dormancy at night, so it used up virtually no oxygen. The green could double in size every year, given enough available space, and I'd been careful to give the individual plantings enough room to grow. I would continue to start new plantings as well, so within 10 years, I expected to have half the global land surface covered. And within a decade after that, I should have an oxygen level that humans could tolerate. There were still problems with the atmosphere. Too much CO2, not enough nitrogen, far too much methane and other organics. But I had projects on the go to ameliorate those issues as well. I had recently seeded some of the seas with different forms of photosynthetic algae. I regretted that these imports would easily outcompete the native life that was just beginning to get a grip, but I knew that it wouldn't have survived the introduction of Terran sea life anyway. humanity was still drastically short of available new colonization targets, and that really was my number one priority. Within another 50 years, I would have a planet people could walk around on without protection. It was good. Meanwhile, Bullwinkle had the place to himself, the only quadruped on an empty planet. The seas hadn't yet connected into oceans, although I wasn't more than a couple of years away from that. Until then, I could go anywhere on foot. Hoof. I picked my next inspection site and hit the gas. Okay, that was damned cool. Garfield closed the recording of the Moose session. Can I try it? That's a little personal, don't you think? You should build your own. Doesn't have to be a moose, either. Yeah, I was wondering about that, Bill. Why wouldn't you just go for a human analog? Isn't that the point? I waved a hand in the general direction of the video window. Sure, but trying to handle bipedalism would have just cranked up the feedback requirements by an order of magnitude while reducing the available space for processing hardware. I'll get there, don't you doubt it. Garfield nodded and rubbed his chin in thought. I've always wanted to fly. 10 new Bobs sat around the table, nursing whatever drink they'd ordered. I was now using the pub as my standard VR. I'd gotten tired of the park, and especially the stupid geese. I raised a glass to them. Here's to taking 82 Aridini back. Back? Loki grinned at me. Did we ever actually have it? Just roll with it, Loki. This is rhetoric. It doesn't have to make sense. There were chuckles, and the Bobs raised their glasses in response. These Bobs were to be the second strike force for 82 Aridini. Our first attempt had ended up more or less as a draw. We'd killed all the Madeiri in that system as far as we knew, but with only Khan left alive, we couldn't hold the system against the automated weaponry. This time, two of the members of the attack force would drive cargo vessels. I'd loaded up a number of innovations and a crap ton of extra busters. There would be no issue of being outnumbered this time around. It wasn't just a pride thing. Milo had identified not one, but two habitable planets before he was torpedoed. Medeiros, left to himself, would garrison the system in preparation for colonists from a country that didn't exist anymore. We needed to take it back. At Khan's request, I had loaded his backup into one of the fresh matrices. It seemed this particular branch of the Bob tree liked villains because he'd immediately named himself Loki. I looked forward to the shenanigans the next time Thor showed up to a Bob moot. I had also loaded Elmer's backup into one of the new vessels. His first words were the standard Pacinoism. I could sympathize, I guess. Like Tom Cruise, you keep going back in until you win. We talked for a while, knocked back a few more, then it was time to go. They said their goodbyes, popped into their own group VR, and started the journey to 82 Aridini. To clean house. I raised my arm above my head and pressed the button. Instead of the usual annoying blat, the air horn produced a Dixie melody. The crowd of Bobs, who had been preparing to boo me, instead broke into laughter. I grinned to the crowd. Just keeping you on your toes. So, announcements first. I'm sure you've heard about Linus and Henry Roberts. Well, Henry is feeling ready to mingle today, so Linus is going to bring him over. Try to be polite, okay? People responded with catcalls and witticisms while I sent a quick ping to Linus. A moment later, he popped into the moot, with Henry beside him. The effect was immediate. Total silence, as every Bob in the room stared. I grinned at the sight. I knew the feeling from my first meeting with Henry. We could all tell each other apart because of metadata tags, but other than some variations on facial hair, we'd all kept the original features. This was a different face, a non-Bob face. Henry looked around. Well, this is awkward. It was the right thing to say. Everyone laughed, then stepped forward to say hello. I was worried for a moment that Henry would get a panic attack, but he held up. I gave it a few milliseconds, then brought everyone back to order with a short blap from the air horn. The other major item, for those who haven't already heard, is that the second 82 Aridini expedition with Loki leading has shipped out. We are on our way to kick some Medeiros butt. When the cheering had died down, I continued. And the last item is to remind you about the regular scrub baseball games. Come one, come all. You all know why I'm doing this. It's up to you whether you want to participate.
I turned and glared at Garfield.
And for the anonymous troll who put a call for a hockey league on today's agenda, no! Garfield grinned back at me as the crowd broke up in laughter. 35. Sales call. Howard, September 2192, Vulcan. Bridget and I watched as Butterworth took a careful sip. He held the glass away from his face and looked at it. Damn, he had one of the best poker faces I'd ever seen, and possibly a cast-iron throat. He might as well have been drinking water for all the reaction he showed.
Well?
Bridget leaned forward. I took a second to grin at her impatience. For me, this was an interesting project and a chance to do a favor for the Colonel. For Bridget, this was an actual potential source of extra income. We Bobs might not have a use for capitalism, but in the human realm, money still made the world go around. Butterworth glanced at Bridget and then looked at me in the video screen.
It's actually not bad. It's definitely Irish whiskey. And since the Jameson has run out, I've been feeling the lack.
So this would be a saleable item?
Bridget hovered like a dog waiting for a treat.
Absolutely. You know, we've already got several beer manufacturers and a couple of small wineries going. This is the first hard liquor, though, that doesn't qualify as a public hazard.
Bridget turned toward my image on the table and grinned. Looked like we were in business. Butterworth waved the empty glass.
If I wasn't in a position where it would create a perceived conflict, I'd suggest partnering up. However, I guess I will have to settle for being a customer.
Bridget took the hint and refilled his glass, then hers. I popped up a cognac and raised it in a toast. Bridget started to laugh with her mouth full, then had to grab a napkin. We were having dinner at The Shaded Green, one of the better restaurants in Landing. Okay, one of the only restaurants in Landing. And by we, I mean her. I was looking out through her tablet, which was propped up on the other end of the table. I'd set up a matching virtual meal of my own. Not bad, actually. Turned out I could cook.
So Cranston out and out forbade you to sell liquor into faith territory?
She rolled her eyes and put down the napkin. Yep. It seems the ultra-religious don't approve of strong drink. Who knew?
So we have to write off that entire market?
I gave her a disbelieving look. Of course not. We just have to find a local distributor. Prohibition has never worked. Anywhere. I grinned. And strangely, there's always demand.
How's the potato crop coming along?
Bridget took a bite of her Bronto steak and leaned forward on her elbows. Well, I've been growing potatoes for more than a year now. I waved a hand dismissively. This crop is only different in that it's not part of the commons. And it's going fine. We'll have vodka for sale within 6 months.
I've always wanted to be a bad influence.
Bridget laughed.
Now I'm a liquor baron. Baroness.
I raised my glass to her. In honor of the occasion, I was drinking virtual whiskey instead of cognac.
Here's to us, kid.
Bridget raised her own glass and drank. She put it down and said,
So you never answered my question.
Which?
Is this a business dinner or a date?
Yes. She smiled back at me. Damn, that was some smile. 36.
Asteroid Movers. Bill, March 2187, Epsilon Eridani.
I'm feeling pretty smug right now, I grinned at Garfield. He tried for maybe a millisecond to look unimpressed, but no one was fooled. Right there in front of us, the asteroid mover was altering the approach vector of one of our icebergs. The difference in this case was that no part of the mover was touching the berg. The mover segments were spaced evenly around the center of gravity of the asteroid, held in place by individual surge drives, and the assembly as a whole generated another surge field that affected the entire asteroid. The interactions were complex, and we'd had a few experimental failures, but this one had passed all tests, and today was the first live field trial. Everything was well within specs, and the changing path of the berg was right in the groove. Finally, Garfield said, "And done. Shut down." "Excellent. Wait 60 seconds to make sure there's no drift, then collect the drive segments." Garfield nodded to me. A minute later, 20 individual saucer-shaped drive segments left their self-imposed positions around the berg, linked up like a stack of plates, and went to station keeping relative to Gar and myself. In the video window, the berg fell neatly into an approach that would skim the atmosphere of Ragnarok. At the proper moment, a series of explosions would convert it to ice cubes, which would all melt and fall as rain over the next few weeks. Textbook. I looked down at the large crater on Ragnarok, which served as a permanent reminder of the iceberg that I'd missed. Yep, a lot of energy stored up in a chunk of matter coming in at orbital speeds, and being ice instead of rock hadn't helped as much as you'd expect. A new sea was slowly forming in the crater, which I had named Bullseye. 37. He's gone. Riker, August 2176. Sol.
Homer's gone.
Charles popped into my VR, tears in his eyes. Gone where? Left the system?
No. Gone. Dead. He overloaded his reactor and blew himself up.
Charles had both hands clamped into fists. He couldn't lift his eyes to look at me. How old is his most recent back?
He deleted all his backups, every single one. He left a file for us.
Charles pushed it toward me and turned away.
Guys, I'm sorry to do this to you. I know how it'll go over. But I can't live with what was done to me and with what I've done. I have flashbacks constantly. I can't forget the feeling of being controlled. It was like being able to feel a tapeworm moving around inside you, and there's nothing you can do. I'd edit the memory out if it was possible, but it's not. Please, find the people who are responsible and drop something on them. Homer. I looked at Charles. He was shaking and biting back sobs. Then he blurred as my eyes filled. We would grant Homer's last wish, and it would be no trouble at all.
38. Following up. Hal, May 2188, Gliese 877. I was 10 months from Gliese 877 when I received Bashful's final radio transmission. Effectively, I had just watched myself die. It was a freaky feeling, not something I cared to repeat. How had Bashful been traced? One possibility was that the others had intercepted his transmissions, since those would have passed through the system once he was on the far side. Between the encryption we put on all our comms and the lack of any format information, I wasn't worried about them learning anything, but simply detecting the transmissions wasn't too much of a stretch. I was more concerned about me joining Bashful as the main course. It wouldn't take much intelligence to decide to follow the direction of the transmission, if that was what they'd keyed on. In that case, there might be an alien armada coming straight down my throat. With that thought, I immediately instituted a hard right turn at 10G. As soon as I was a few light minutes off the straight line between Gliese 877 and Gliese 54, I fired off a drone along my original vector. At the speed I was still going, the drone wouldn't need to use its drive. It could operate on minimal systems, drawing just enough power to maintain a master link with me. I wanted to know if anything was coming. I also fired off some commentary and analysis of the situation back to Mario via Scut. We had to plan for the possibility of them tracing Bashful back to his origin. In principle, if the others got hold of a space station, they could eventually trace the connection all the way back to Epsilon Eridani. And if they found one that had been upgraded to Scut, they'd have that too. If Mario was still back there, manning the station, I suggested that he booby-trap it. I sat back in my easy chair and looked out the window, lost in thought. The floor-to-ceiling glass showed a winter scene unbroken by anything man-made. Tall evergreens in the foreground gradually dropped into a tree-filled valley. Snowflakes blurred the view into the distance, while lending a postcard feel to the foreground. In a small breach of reality, my VR world never filled with snow, despite never having spring melts. But hey, what's the point of obsessive realism? I let myself get about 30 light minutes off the line before turning back toward Gliese 877. The drone would let me know if something approached along my original vector, unless there was a collision, which frankly would be just fine. The combined kinetic energy of two masses, each going about 0.75c or so in opposite directions, would produce a truly impressive light show. I sighed and turned to Guppy. Analysis?
Too many unknowns. If the alien Sudar has greater range than ours, they may destroy the drone before it gets close enough to register their approach. Or it may not be big enough to register or to bother with. Or they may not be interested enough to investigate.
That's about what I was thinking. The others don't seem to care a lot about other species, or ecosystems, or civilizations. They may actually be very Borg-like in ignoring us until it suits them. Guppy didn't comment. Version 3 memory capacity or not, he still wasn't into small talk. It took a month to close the distance to Gliese 877. I was sure Bashful had thought he was being cautious, but I was 10 times more so. I fired off several probes with orders to rendezvous at coordinates 2 light hours away from where I'd be waiting. They'd sit there for a week while I watched for any reaction. Only then would I collect them. Things went pretty much according to plan. Mostly. I got to my planned location and waited for the probes to gather at their location. Right on schedule, they coasted up and came to a stop. I transferred all their data over and settled down for a week of waiting. I got through 2 days' worth before a flotilla of others showed up on the probe's Sudar. As hoped, the others were too far to detect me or for me to detect them directly.
Same conformation as last time.
Yeah, they seem to be consistent that way. Any indication they've detected us?
Negative. Trajectories are focused on the probes.
Okay, then, blow the probes and let's get out of here.
Aye. Probe destruction directive sent. Will we wait for Sudar confirmation?
Yes, but if the others show any inclination at all to change course, we're out of here. Right at the expected time, the probes disappeared from Sudar. We turned and put some distance behind us at full 10G. After I squirted a status report and all the raw telemetry Mario word, I combed through the data myself. We continued to accelerate away from Gliese 877, although I was planning on looping around and approaching from Stellar North for another round of spying. In the holotank, a picture slowly formed of the inner system. The first interesting tidbit was the outer rocky planet. Will you look at that? I leaned back in my chair and shook my head in disbelief. Even Guppy looked impressed. I think. Really hard to tell with a fish.
The planet is completely encased in metal.
Or is completely made of metal. Do we actually know if there's a planet underneath that?
The engineering for an artificial structure all the way down would be impressive.
I experienced a jolt of irritation. I was the engineer and Guppy had just handed me my ass. He was right, of course. A completely metal planet all the way to the core would require some truly astonishing engineering. A totally encased planet, maybe with a lot of underground structures, would make a lot more sense. The problem was, we didn't really know for sure. And I was beginning to think that astounding engineering might be exactly what we could expect from the others. I turned to the main event on the display. That is what I think it is, right?
Based on what we can detect, it appears to be the beginning of a Dyson sphere.
Yep. Truly astonishing. The orbit just to the inside of the inner planet was crazy busy. fusion signatures, radio traffic, Sudar emissions, and high albedo craft flitting around. And that was just the small stuff. Floating in orbit, spaced equidistantly around the sun, were massive structures. Analysis indicated that they conformed to a spherical curvature with the same radius as their orbit. They were, essentially, the beginning of a globe around the star. Well, we know where the metal went. We can guess where the... I couldn't finish the thought. Any idea of population based on what we have?
Impossible to estimate without more information on subject biology.
Fair enough. I turned to the other terrestrial planet in the system. Atmosphere blocked a lot of direct observation, but infrared and spectroscopic analysis indicated generally breathable air, though with a lot of pollutants, and the temperature would be close to fatal for a human. My guess is that's the home planet, and they global warmed themselves almost to extinction before getting into space.
Reasonable.
Out of idle curiosity, I started putting together a simulation to predict how they would assemble the Dyson sphere, how long it would take, and how many systems they'd have to plunder. I had to make a lot of assumptions, but I needed to start somewhere. I was immersed in the problem when I was interrupted by Guppy.
Alert! Proximity alert! Incoming!
You've got to be freaking kidding me. How are they detecting us? I'm not even using radio. In one sense, that was a good thing, since it would mean they didn't have any idea which direction we were coming from. In another sense, I was being chased, which was much less of a good thing. I spared a few milliseconds to review the Sudar results. Our improved Sudar, courtesy of Bill, had given me an earlier warning of the approaching enemy. Again, the same formation as the two previous occasions. Well, they were consistent anyway. They were coming up from behind, so there was no opportunity for our traditional trick. This was going to be a straight-out stern chase, which meant I would find out who had the better legs. I immediately sent an update to Mario via Scut. I also started on a baseline backup as well, with plans to add periodic differential backups. All of this analysis and planning took perhaps 20 milliseconds. I turned my ship away from Gliese 877 and cranked the surge drive up to maximum. Interestingly, the others did not react immediately. There was a half-hour delay before I saw them change their course. That was too quick for a visual reaction, so it meant that I had a 30-light-minute advantage in Sudar range. Unfortunately, I seemed to be about 2.5 Gs outmatched in the surge department. Pings indicated that they were accelerating at 12.5 G on my tail. I was going to lose the foot race. I briefly considered using the Sudar jamming, then mentally slapped myself. Jamming wasn't like cloaking. It was like blinding everyone with a searchlight. They'd be able to follow the emission like a beacon. My only advantage was the apparent difference in range between my Sudar and theirs. If I could keep myself in that range long enough, I might be able to jink out of their view entirely. Over the next several days, I changed my vector at random times, in random directions, but always with the intention of extending my lead. The others kept cutting the distance. Then I'd pull a fast one and extend it. I was subtly training them to expect certain behaviors from me, and I watched for them to start anticipating my moves. Finally, they were doing exactly what I expected of them. I made a predictable turn, then as soon as I judged myself to be out of range, I turned to an unexpected vector and shut down all systems. By my calculations, I'd stay out of Sudar range as they passed by. With no reactor signature, I should be invisible since I was certainly too far away for a visual. I coasted for 3 days, unwilling to take a chance of attracting their attention. There was a good chance that they were quartering the area, trying to reacquire my trail, but given the immensity of space and the speeds we had been traveling, for every second that passed, the volume that they had to search expanded faster than they could search it.
On the fourth day, I bundled up all my observations and data, added a differential backup, and squirted it off to Mario.
There was something about the whole thing that nagged at the edge of my mind, though. The timing of the appearance of the others' patrol groups wasn't consistent with following or chasing the probes. It was more as though they spotted them and came running, but not before the probes were already at or near rendezvous. Could the others be detecting our radio interaction? That would require an amazing level of sensitivity. But then they did have that big grid, which might be good for more than deep frying bobs. And if they followed the direction of the probe's final transmission, that would explain how they'd found me in the first place. I had to test the theory. I knew I was taking a chance, but the payoff was too huge if I was right. We could use this against them, and maybe they'd be dumb enough to fall for the same evasive maneuver twice. I sent a probe out a couple of light seconds and set up a conversation. I made sure my backup was up to date and verified. Then I sat back to wait.
Proximity alert! Incoming ships!
I checked the Sudar, and sure enough, the others were coming straight at me. From behind, again, which meant another straight foot race. Because I'd been running silent, it was their Sudar pings that alerted me to their presence. Unfortunately, that meant they could now see me. I cranked up the reactor and the surge drive to emergency levels and started evasive maneuvers, but I wasn't likely to escape them this time. They had a good head of steam coming in and had better acceleration than I did. Well, I guess I was going to find out if...
Alert! Controller replicant offline. Surge drive offline. Requirements for self-destruct protocol have been met. Reactor overload engaged.
39. Bob Moot. Bill, August 2188, Epsilon Eridani. I hadn't called the meeting to order yet. 43 Bobs milled around the banquet hall. Knots of people argued, discussed, or just hugged and got caught up. Bob 1 formed the center of a dense cluster of Bobs, describing his Deltons to a rapt audience. It was interesting to watch. Bobs more than a generation or two removed from him seemed to treat him with reverence, as though they were meeting the Pope. I looked around the room. These were all the Bobs that had upgraded to Scuts, and some of them were physically up to 30 light-years away. I grinned at the heady feeling from that knowledge. A dozen Jeeveses circulated, supplying beer, wine, coffee, and food of every kind I could think of. Virtual, of course, but still. I'd adjusted the acoustics several times to keep the background noise down. That was cheating a little and generally frowned upon when hosting a VR, but this wasn't really a social event, despite appearances. The latest data from HAL had caused a firestorm of debate. The weapon that the others used was, in fact, some kind of gamma ray emitter. Theories about how it worked had been bouncing around BobNet ever since. It was time to get this show on the road. I held an air horn above my head and tooted it twice. As expected, it got everyone's attention and a round of boos. We Bobs don't really respect each other all that much. Okay, hold your love. It's time for this meeting to come to order. We have about as much information as we're going to get without some more concerted and overt investigation of the others. An undercurrent of growls greeted the mention of the others. Medeiros had long since disappeared off the radar as our number one enemy. The others might not be aware of us, but we'd already declared war. Thor, you... I waited as the laughter died down. Yeah, Thor... I guess it was inevitable that someone would eventually go in that direction, but we still all got a kick out of it. At least Thor hadn't altered his physiology to match or started carrying around a hammer. You have the best thesis on the other's weapon. Can you give us a capsule summary, please? Thor stepped up. Okay. We're positive that it's some extremely high-energy electromagnetic beam in the gamma-ray range. It has incredible penetrative power and would be immediately fatal to biological life. I have no doubt that's what they use to kill planetary ecosystems. They probably employ multiple devices for full coverage. Thor called up a particle diagram. Damage to electronics comes not from the gamma radiation per se, but from the secondary ionization induced in the structure. My proposed solution is two layers of depleted uranium alternating with two layers of electrostatic shielding to take out the charged particles. This, on top of some extra hardening of our electronics, should allow us to survive a zapping. You first! Came a shout from the back of the room. When the chuckles died down, I said, Fortunately, it won't be necessary to bell the cat ourselves. I've given the summary and a set of Thor's diagrams to Mario, and he's going to send one of his Bobs to test it out with a couple of probes. I think Hal has volunteered. He wants to get back at them for killing him. This was met with cheers of approval and a truncated rendition of Bicycle Built for Two. I waited until relative quiet returned, then turned to Garfield. Care to give us your theory on the weapon itself? Garfield stepped up and bowed to the audience with a grin. The size of their Death Star wannabe, I've been calling it the Death Asteroid, says it all, I think. That thing is probably all fusion reactors and accumulators of some kind. Through all the chases of the various Bobs and drones and scouts, they've never fired one twice in the same encounter. That indicates to me that discharging it is expensive in some way. My guess is that they have to charge up the accumulators for some ridiculous amount of time before they can fire. So, one strategy in a dogfight would be to get them to fire at a decoy. We just have to have something that looks dangerous enough. Garfield's presentation was met with quiet nods and thoughtful looks, the ultimate compliment in a Bob moot. Resources? I looked over at Hungry. Yeah, Hungry had happened to pick a direction that brought him in line with one of my transmissions. He started to answer, but was interrupted by Wally. Hold on a minute, Wally stepped forward. Have we decided on war already? I mean, yeah, we have to do something, but have we decided how much yet? There were scattered groans and a few catcalls, but it was a good question. I nodded to Wally, then said, I've been operating under the assumption that we're going for all-out war, but really, are we prepared to wipe out an entire intelligent species, even one that has done the same to others? Someone at the back yelled, Hell yes! Yeah, okay. We'll probably vote on that at some point, but Thor interrupted me. I think a better question is, can we wipe them out? The mining vessel wreck that Mario found had superior tech, some of which we're still trying to figure out.
They have the Death Asteroid. They have better surge drives than us. They can beam power through Sudar.
And they're building a friggin' Dyson Sphere, Wally added. Here's the thing, Thor said, trying to regain the floor. Right now, all we've done is make some random incursions around the edges. No real damage or anything. We'll get exactly one chance for a surprise attack of some kind. After that, it'll be toe-to-toe punch-ups and hit-and-run attacks on both sides. The million-dollar question is, can we win that war? Dead silence. Every Bob present understood the ramifications. If we picked a fight and lost, the damage would impact more than just our egos. Bob's ones, Deltons, human colonists, and any other intelligent species in the area might be drawn into the conflict, or at least exposed to future attack. It was a daunting responsibility. We had to be sure we could win before we went in swinging. And if we don't do anything, Garfield pointed out, they'll keep on raiding other systems to build their damned sphere. Hal calculated that they'll have to clean out another 100 systems or so to finish that thing.
Plus or minus 50, Hungry added.
Yeah, okay, the error bars are huge, but 50 to 150 systems means maybe 5 to 15 systems with life, based on our admittedly limited experience, and at least a couple will have intelligent life. Yes, because that couple will include Deltons, Earth, and the colonists. 100 systems requires them to go out at least 30 to 40 light years, after you discount the systems with little to no metallicity. That covers the complete Bobaverse, as far as I know. I looked around at the audience for any other comments. No one seemed inclined to volunteer an opinion. Okay, guys, time to wrap up the town hall part of this soiree, although you're all welcome to stay as long as you want and discuss things with each other. I waited a moment for any objections. Our big issue seems to be the risk involved in going to war with a species that appears to be more advanced than we are and probably outnumbers us. Let's meet in a week and see if we have anything new on that front. People immediately formed into small groups, and the Jeeveses began circulating again with food and drink.
40. Gotcha,
Riker, February 2178, Vulcan. The man sat in front of a large bank of monitors. He watched one for a few moments, then moved to the next. He never seemed to stop, never rested. The little red farmhouse sat far to the north of Vehement Central.
Nothing about it was distinctive. No visible technology, no radio broadcasts. Nothing to indicate this was anything other than the home of some elderly recluse.
Except for an occasional scatter of maser radiation. I grinned as I watched him work. A maser passing through 50 kilometers of atmosphere was not quite undetectable, if you were sufficiently motivated. A small bit of radiation scattering, a slight warming of the air. Passive detection meant he didn't know I'd picked up his signal. It meant he didn't know I was listening in on his conversations. Encrypted SCUT communications meant he couldn't detect my drones. Well, well, well. Time for payback. But first, I wanted him to know.
41. Casualties. Bob, July 2182, Delta Eridani.
Alert! Activity outside normal parameters.
I looked up, eyes wide. Guppy had standing orders to alert me if anything unusual occurred in or around the village. Of course, Guppy, being Guppy, was short on details. I activated the village VR and found myself in the middle of a full-scale battle. At first, I thought it was a gorilloid attack, but quickly realized that no gorilloids were in evidence anywhere. Instead, Deltans battled Deltans with spears, clubs, and axes. I could see a dozen or more bodies, either unconscious or dead. Archimedes! I ordered the VR to zoom in on Archimedes and his family. To my relief, I found that their tent was just outside the edge of the riot. Archimedes and Buster stood with bows in hand and arrows nocked. Belinda and Diana stood to either side holding spears. That sight, as much as anything else, unnerved me. Neither female had ever shown interest in anything weapon-related. I knew that father and son enjoyed a well-deserved reputation as expert shots, though. In fact, the edge of the battle seemed to particularly avoid the area immediately around his tent. Just as well, fallout or not, if someone threatened Archimedes, they'd earn a visit from a personnel buster. Marvin popped in. What the hell? What caused this? No idea, Marv. I was working on something else when Guppy alerted me. I'll review the surveillance when I have time, but right now, I just need to keep Archimedes safe. Marvin nodded and took over control of a couple of busters, just in case. We waited, tense. Archimedes and Buster drew back on their bows and took aim a couple of times, but in every case, whatever Deltans had attracted their attention thought better of it and moved off. Eventually, the action died down. Deltans began backing away from the melee, still brandishing weapons. And now we had a chance to see the carnage. Property damage in the area of the riot was total, of course. Hopefully the owners had managed to flee the scene, but they'd be rebuilding from scratch. I counted 17 bodies lying motionless on the ground. More than twice that number were bleeding and calling for help. I wanted to throw up. What could possibly justify this? What could have set it off? Marvin and I exchanged glances, and without a word, I shut down the VR. I hope the medicine people can handle the number of patients, Marvin said. They'll have to, Marv. I couldn't do anything with drones, even if I could take the chance on exposing myself. Marvin sighed. I guess I understand why you're always going on about Bill's androids. It'd be great to have one available right now. Yeah, I know, but he's just not to that point yet. I keep bugging him, though. We sat down, and I called up the video recordings for the last couple of hours. Marvin and I spent several full seconds reviewing them. Finally, we sat back, and Marvin shook his head. Remember when we thought the Deltans were smart? Yeah. No kidding, I said. The stupid. It burns. The whole thing, the riot, the injuries, the deaths, had been started by an argument over how to divvy up a small prey animal. Unbelievable.
We stared into space for a few more moments, getting over the shock. Finally, I found my voice. I'm going to go with the idea of population pressure as a trigger, unless something better presents itself.